This episode is brought to you by NordVPN. Listen up, nerds. No. Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America, from border to border and coast to coast and all the ships at sea.
What?
Hello, friends. Do you have a computer? Of course you do, because it's not 1987. Hell, you're listening to this on some kind of computer right now. But do you have a VPN?
Oh,
what's a VPN, you ask? Well, my friend, a VPN is a virtual private network and it offers two key benefits. Enhanced privacy and security online. But VPNs do a lot more than that. VPNs shield your IP address, change your browsing location, and make online life easier. It's all about safety and security, my friends. But like everything else in life, it's also about watching TV. Don't let your paid subscriptions go to waste. I use NordVPN to access my home content while I'm traveling. Wink, wink. Plus, secure your connection on public Wi-Fi in airports, hotels, cafes, anywhere you go when you're traveling. There's over 6,300 servers in 111 countries, and you can find a nearby server for the best VPN speeds. NordVPN is easy to use. Connect with one click or enable auto-connect for zero-click protection. And it's got amazing speed. NordVPN is one of the fastest VPNs out there. And with just one NordVPN account, you can use it on 6 devices. It supports every major platform, Windows, Android, iOS, macOS, Linux, even Android TV. I think those are all real. Don't miss out on all the awesome benefits for using a VPN. Go to nordvpn.com/ifanboy today for a risk-free 30-day money-back guarantee. The link's in the show notes. Once again, that's nordvpn.com/ifanboy.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You ever feel like you really need to get something off your chest? This is like a real thing. Like, if you're mad, if you're upset, if there's something going on, like there's often for me an idea. Maybe it's a wrong. Maybe it's a moment. It's an injustice. It's something that just you keep going on and on, over and over in your mind about it, and like that can create anger and resentment or shame, whatever it is. And very often, I have found, I am not a therapist, I have found that when you let it out, when you give it voice, when you say it out loud, sometimes it makes you feel better because you've expressed it. And sometimes it makes you realize like, oh, this is not a big deal, but it's been stuck in my head. So you give voice to those things, and it can make you feel a lot better. And shock of all shocks, therapy is one of those things that can help you do that. It can help you be able to say those things in a place where you don't need to worry about the repercussions of it, work your way through it, figure out coping skills, how to get around it, you know, find ways to deal with that stuff instead of letting it fester. If you are thinking of starting therapy, if anything I said sounds familiar, you're like, oh, maybe my life would be a little better if I could deal with that kind of thing. You should give BetterHelp a try. It's fully online. It is convenient, flexible. It is suited to your schedule. That's the idea. That's what they're going for. You can fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. That's a big deal. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. That personal connection, I believe, to be super important. Again, I'm not a professional. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/ifanboy today. You get 10% off your first month. That is BetterHelp, HELP.com/ifanboy.
This is the iFanboy Pick of the Week podcast, episode 438, brought to you by iFanboy listeners like you.
Picture yourself in a boat on a river with tangerine trees and marmalade skies. Somebody calls you, you answer quite slowly. A girl with kaleidoscope eyes.
iFanboy Pick of the Week podcast. I popped my P on that. I don't know why I did that.
Good thing you got a pop screen.
Yeah, I don't.
Oh,
episode 400. What are we, Ron Comics? Episode 438. They had pop screens. I remember I got there the first time I ever went to like do a recording with them. I was like, oh, look at you guys.
I have one, and it's much, much more noticeable when I'm not using it.
Well, the thing that you don't know is that I do shows with a stocking pulled over my head. So,
and then you go rob a bank.
Yeah, I mean, I like having the option. I want to have the freedom for it.
I have a pop filter. Now. Mine doubles as a dream catcher.
That's nice.
Right up to my window.
Yeah. Mine apparently doubles as a pollution catcher looking at it. I never even actually looked at it before.
I bet it smells delicious.
Ooh. There's probably bacteria on this. Let's continue the show.
I would say there's bacteria on everything. My name is Josh Flanagan. I have bacteria all over me. Joining me are Paul Montgomery.
Hey there.
Festering with bacteria. And of course, bacteria pool Connor Kilpatrick.
There's a lot of ways we could go with that one. I'll go with the one that's going to get me the least amount of trouble and say, hello. Hey,
you take a pill, it's all fine. We are iFanboy. We like comics and certain maladies. Others, not so much.
It burns for a while and it's over.
Yeah, but you want to take care of it or you go insane. We like comics, and every week we read a lot of them. One of us picks the best one they read. We do that in a cycle. See, one week it's my week. Another week it's the other week. It's not just random, and I feel like I implied that. I want to make sure you understand.
Paul, we're the other.
The pick of the week. We talk about it in the podcast. We're going to talk about other books from the week and some other stuff. We will try to be humorous and informative at the same time, but also stay on a course. So it takes a lot of effort to do this show.
Before we get going, it rolling like a train.
Yes. Yeah, that's what I just want. I feel like I need the validation right now. Before we get going, we are going to talk about what happens in the book. So as you may or may not understand, that means that if you haven't read them, they'll be completely ruined. The colloquialism for that is a spoiler. So watch out for spoilers.
Spoilers.
Spoilers. Paul, you had the pick.
Have you guys ever read a comic and finished it only to find you have a horrible case of the flop sweats? Because yeah, Deadly Class.
Because I read my comics while walking down the street in Manhattan in July.
Deadly Class number 5 was, I thought, a very, very sensual comic book. It's a feast for the senses, is what I'm saying. Rick Remender, Wes Craig, Lee Lowridge. This is sort of a raucous issue, and it totally delivers on the promise of the previous issue about bad things happening while on acid. This is an acid trip issue.
I wonder if anybody read this on acid. If you did read this while you were on acid, please comment on the comment.
When I mentioned online that this was the pick, there were a lot of people like, it really accurately depicts what an acid trip is like. And my only experience, local urban acid legends, and then that episode of Taxi with Reverend Jim. That's why I brought that up. So this is just an extended trip, and even if it weren't an acid trip, it would still be a very exciting issue because we've got Marcus, our main character, teenager, who has, you know, some issues of abuse from his past, from his childhood, and he is helping, and maybe that's part of the reason that he's agreed to help out this other kid kill his dad. They're going to Las Vegas and they're going to kill his father because you can't kill your dad on your own. No, you need a little bit of backup.
A team of highly irresponsible teenage killers.
Exactly. While tripping balls.
While tripping balls, exactly. And so they're in their hotel room and like, we're going to do this. And the whole time Marcus is going through this, you know, this weird cognitive experience where he's paranoid, really anxious, second guessing himself, he's hallucinating. It's like, you know, a Daffy Duck cartoon in parts of it, just hyper expressive. And I mean, it's like there are moments in here where he's so freaked out that he, you know, looks like, you know, that painting The Scream. Like he's just, his face is all contorted and everything. And he eventually does help kill this other kid's father and he goes on the run. And what's great about this, there's this great framing device where he's in an interrogation room talking to a policeman, and you assume, you know, that we know this murder is coming up. You assume that it's, you know, part of that, but it's actually because he was underage and in a casino and played the slots because Mr. T said that you'd be a fool if you didn't. In this Mr. T themed slot machine. And so they bring him in and say, listen, you know, you made all this money. We'll let you go, but just we keep the money. And he's like, okay, fine. Because he knows that he's got this murder on his hands.
I feel like he was keeping the money. That's just
Well, right. Well, yeah.
Either way.
This corrupt, you know, security guy at the casino, right.
It's not corrupt. Everybody gets paid.
Everybody got their taste, Paul.
Squeaky wheel gets
the taste. It's part of the gig. You don't take that gig. You don't expect to get your beak a little wet.
Mm-hmm. I've seen The Wire. I know how it works.
Paul, Casino.
Okay.
Come on.
Paul, Josh, either one of you may feel free to answer.
I was actually thinking of a different Scorsese film. I was thinking of After Hours, where it's just this raucous chase and one thing leads to another and it's completely absurd. Because in addition to this murder and this whole casino thing, there's this jilted ex-boyfriend who is very angry at this kid because even though Marcus is after the other girl, this one girl is after him, and she decides that, you know, this would be a great opportunity to create the beast with two backs. Am I allowed to say that on this podcast?
Yes. Did you guys read the letter in the back from Rick Remender?
Yeah, that was my favorite part.
We've talked in the past, or in the past, it's only been 4 or 5 issues, but we talked about this book, about how it's Rick bleeding on the page very viscerally.
Yeah.
And in the back of this issue, he has a little essay explaining that the events in this issue are loosely based on two separate events in his life.
All the events are true other than the murder part.
One is the tripping balls part. The other is getting beat down part. And it was a very interesting essay.
The bit on the elevator, where it's like, I don't know what to say on an elevator. What are you supposed to say on an elevator? I don't know elevator etiquette. That felt like it has to be, you know, ripped from the headlines of Rick Remender's life.
That was like a scene out of Louie.
Mm-hmm. The thing is, there's a lot of, tropes, genre tropes, but this book, it's a school for assassins and what have you. But we've talked about it before. The real draw of this book for me is how real it feels, because Rick is drawing on his life, or at least his emotional life. In this case, some specifics, but it feels so real and relatable, even though I have not been in a murder school and or been tripping on acid in a casino in Vegas. I still feel very close to these characters because of it, the emotional reality of it.
Yeah.
Which is wonderful.
And this issue in particular, like the assassin school, like hardly even plays a role. I mean, this could just be like two kids.
It could be any group of teenagers committing a murder,
right. Yeah.
Kind of, the assassin school is kind of the least interesting part of the whole series for me.
Yes.
And I think that like the emotional truth, the whichever, and by reading that, knowing that that's a thing, that does make the book more attractive. Like it makes it more interesting. It gives it context. One of the other things that I just think that we've been very effusive about Wes Craig the whole time, and I think he really went out of his way to be excellent this time. There was definitely some like David Aja type influence going on with this in a good way, not in a he's just copying that. I just think some of it was absorbed into sort of the storytelling of this, which wasn't hurt at all by the coloring either.
I love the fight scene while tripping, and there was multiple images of each guy fighting, and it was just very imaginatively drawn.
But also, like that scene, the entire like the panels all of a sudden got really big. So all of a sudden, it was like we went into widescreen from watching all these little tiny panels and jerky movements and things to these big four panel pages that you know don't. Like everything just got bigger and more. It was like zooming in on everything, you know, making the picture bigger.
That's what they did on Superman Doomsday.
Yeah.
Like from issue to issue, the panels got bigger. I mean, as much as we sort of, you know, dismiss that whole storyline, like that's an interesting kind of technique. And I agree. Like, I think this, it should be said that this was like a really terrific week of comics. I thought there were really, really great choices. And any other week, I mean, it could have been any of like five different comics could have been the pick. But this one, I think it comes down to that last sequence and that fight sequence and that sort of, you know, $6 million man kind of, you know, arm coming up for the punch and seeing all the movement and everything. And really it has all the senses buzzing. It really capably captures, if not an acid trip, if I don't know what an acid trip is like, I at least know what disorientation is like. I know what waking up is like or being tired is like. And I think that's captured pretty capably here.
Now, what was interesting to me is that I know that you, Paul, like me, not a big fan of dream sequences, surrealism, these kind of things. And so when you go into doing a scene like this, like you could famously go back to hallucination scenes from, say, The Sopranos or something like that.
Right.
And go, I could do without those scenes. But this didn't fall into that category for you, which I think is interesting.
Right, because it's about the experience. It does. I don't necessarily. We talk about, you know, Remender, you know, bleeding on the page here, but I don't feel the hand of the author in the way that, you know, unlike a Mad Men dream sequence or a Soprano sequence where it feels like it's all symbolism. I think here it's all about experience and sensations. Mm-hmm. And it's a very lucid way of depicting disorientation.
Yeah.
Side note, Josh, didn't you meet Mr. T?
I did. I kind of forgot about that a long time ago. Yeah. That,
we'll tell back, you, working back on, when you were 22 years old?
Working on really opened a lot of doors. I met Mr. T. I met DDP at one point before he was a yoga magnate. I met, of course, who went on to be very famous. But back then, he played one of the guys on the show, and he beat up a contestant, and that contestant sued us. he got mad about something. Yeah.
I have a story about being kicked out of a casino before being too young, but I'll put that in the comments because it's way too long to tell on the show. All right. All-Star Western 31. I don't really have a lot to say about it other than I want to mention it because the book was just announced as being canceled.
Yeah.
With issue 34. And I feel like I want to just mention every issue until then because this is one of those books that, Josh, you recall, is one of those books that started up the same year we started the podcast. So I feel like it's always been around. And it ending is going to be very strange. So I'm going to keep mentioning it until it goes away.
Wait, is there one more issue left? Or how many?
No, three more.
Three more.
37? 34 is a lost issue. 34 is a lost issue.
Darwin Cook's number 34. Now, what's interesting about this, though, is that I'm reading it and I'm like, oh, this is just like the old times. In fact, they even kind of had that sense. Like, this is like the old, like, stabbed in the face with an eye or with a key.
I think they must have known because you recall you listening and you on the call with me that we mentioned how it abruptly changed direction back towards the old book.
Yep.
You know, there was that conceit of Jonah Hex first in Gotham, then he went to the future, and then he came back, and then suddenly they just basically got rid of all that. Now it's suddenly back to Jonah and Tallulah, and this could have been the old book. Except Jonah Hex's face is fixed.
Well, that, but also it was only half a book.
Right. Well, there's that.
I mean, like, but the other half of the story is Madame 44, which I literally didn't read. I just looked at the
I didn't either.
Jose Luis. But I did look at all the art. I went through all of the Jose Luis.
That was really good. But this little scene with Jonah and Tallulah Black trying to have a nice romantic dinner interrupted by a bunch of bad guys and then the fight that ensues, I thought it was great.
They humped on the bar.
And then they had wild sex on the bar until the sheriff came and went,
waving his hat like a rodeo rider.
I just think this has been, and you mentioned this on Twitter when the announcement came in, Josh, that there's, I'm not really sad that it was canceled because,
come on,
100 however many issues of this book is really an amazing accomplishment for a Western book in this modern era where genre books die a quick death from the DC and Marvel books.
And other than, like, I get the editorial, they had to go do a different thing to try to keep the book going, but it's the same two writers, you know, who had nothing but excellent art. There were no shitty fill-ins. There were just really good artists on it all the way through. There was a very consistent vision of what the character was. And I mean, I think it's interesting. I didn't really think about it in terms of us, but it was like one of our first episodes was Jonah Hex 1. And we've, you know, sort of all been on it since then. And that's amazing.
So let's not eulogize it too much because I feel like we're going to have a lot of time to do that. And I suspect with Darwin Cook art in the final issue that there's a very good chance it'll be pick of the week unless evil Paul Montgomery has that pick that week.
If Darwin Cook is on it, there's a very good chance I would pick that for pick of the week.
So we'll get it. I guarantee we'll get a chance to fully eulogize the series, but I just wanted to mention that this was a really fun story and I'm really happy this book made it for the 8 or 9 years it did, which is really amazing for a cowboy book.
I've been a little off and on lately, but now that it's, you know, closing out, I will be reading all of the issues left. And
I would start, I think, was it the last issue, Josh, that they switched back to the old sort of stories?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I'll go back and start with 30 and just read.
Okay, well, I read this issue and I liked it. And when you guys said that Tallulah Black was back, you know.
You don't really have to go back.
His face got fixed while he was in the future and now his face is normal. So it's confusing everybody who doesn't, they don't actually believe he's Jonah Hex, which is funny, I think. But
yeah.
Go ahead.
So I think that if I had the pick this week, I almost definitely would have gone with Trees number 1.
It was a super strong contender. It was
from Image Comics, Warren Ellis and Jason Howard. Couple of reasons about this. One, it's just a really great sci-fi conceit in a world a little removed from our own, and some shit has gone down. We'll get into that in a second. So great concept from Warren Ellis. Didn't really feel like Warren Ellis. The concept did, but the sort of writing of it, the sort of structure, the people.
The badass hasn't shown up yet.
Yeah, no, like it didn't feel like I was reading a Warren Ellis book. And a lot of that I think had to do with Jason Howard, who you may remember from the Astounding Wolfman, who did a very animated cartoony kind of style in this, and this he's bringing out a whole different style, and it was wonderful. He looks like a great BPRD artist is what he looks like.
Yes.
And he drew all these sort of interesting people and these cityscapes of a world where 10 years ago these giant ships landed that are like long, huge, tall columns ascending into the clouds. You can't see the top of. They call them trees.
Trees, and eventually, if you will.
The people just lived with them, and they built houses around the roots. We join the story sort of right when they emit a noxious liquid.
In a while, the trees bleed like a toxic waste kind of sap.
Yeah,
toxic sap
that kills people and melts things. I don't know if they knew that that was going to be a thing that happened.
We've talked about this before with all these new Image books, and every once in a while, a first issue will feel a little prologue-y.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I thought this was a little bit – I really liked this a lot. I want to preface that by saying mm-hmm. I really, really, really enjoyed this more than I thought I would. But it also felt a little prologue-y. Like we've mentioned in the past, a couple of these series, the first issue could have been combined with the second for an oversized issue, number one. It would have been satisfying. This felt a little prologue-y, but still
– I get that.
But still, I really liked it a lot.
I'm getting used to that sort of pacing, that way of doing things, and it's totally cool. But for me, like end of the day, like really, the story was Jason Howard just busting out of all the boundaries that he had before and delivering on a ton of levels. Artist too, it should be noted, like pencils, inks, color.
It's sort of like if William Gibson did a version of Pacific Rim, it's like this is the new normal. And we live in this world where there's these, this extraterrestrial presence. They're not kaiju roaming around. It's creepier than that because they're just there.
They don't do anything.
Things, yeah. But then also, not even just from that, but also, it's sort of next week's, Wired headlines. Like, there's drones in the skies. They've got that. Isn't that Google-funded, like, quadruped robot thing? Did you guys see the videos of that? Like, it's this thing that gallops, and like, Jesus Christ, that's terrifying if that's going to be on, like, future battlefields. And so they grab that. So it's this dog-like robot, and that's a real thing. That's a thing that, the military is working on. So I thought this was crazy, and I like the approach that it's like going around like different places in the world. We're in, Rio de Janeiro, and I think we're in, like, the Arctic Circle at one point, and...
We're all over the world. We're in New York City with the new possible mayor. Was it the mayor or the new possible mayor? Either one.
He's running for mayor.
I want him to stick with this so bad.
Yeah.
I'm so afraid of the Warren Ellis fadeaway.
Right.
Because this is cool. And you're right. It's like a very early, like, and you're seeing a ton of possibilities that it can be. Just really, really great, great first issue. Super impressive.
Yeah. And if it's a prologue, it worked because I'm excited for more.
Yeah. Yeah.
This week also saw the end of Charles Soule's run on Thunderbolts 26. This was a book that I wasn't reading, then both Josh and I believe also Paul were raving about it, so I jumped on and was happy I did, although I really found myself very disinterested in this particular story arc that ended the run. But
With the celestial baby head?
This run's been each person gets a mission, and this particular mission of General Thunderbolt Ross is in the jungle with the pyramids, and I just didn't really care about it.
Okay, I can see that. I think the reason that I'm in it, the thing that's intriguing to me is watching them all interact with each other. And so you're seeing, I really like Deadpool, who everyone thinks is nuts, and he actually knows everything that's going on, and Hammond, who thinks he's got the drop on everybody, except Deadpool doesn't. And I really like that a lot. And the
characters are great. I think that's always been the stellar thing about the book.
It's a really good Deadpool.
Yeah,
like in the same way that like Remender did a really good Deadpool in that team, like it works here. And if you were to, I was going to say if you were to tell me these were the guys on the team, I wouldn't like it. But that's actually exactly what happened. Is that when they started it and Daniel Way took over, these are the guys on the team. I said that's stupid. I don't want to read it. But it was done into something really cool. I think the thing that's disappointing about it is that he's clearly not done with whatever his story was. There's definitely, the sort of the retribution of Hammond or how that's all going to work out. Like Soul is not going to be the one who finishes that story. Somebody else is. Right. So that's sort of disappointing. And I don't even know who's coming on next. But I'm, this definitely had a thing. And I think one of the other things that was really impressive about it is that we've talked about all sorts of his books. This one really doesn't feel like any of the other ones. It's a really sort of interesting and unique book. God, it almost makes me want to check out the Red Lantern book, even though I don't want to check out the Red Lantern book, but I'm just so curious.
Well, he's writing every book that comes out or every second.
Yeah,
book,
I mean, so this was basically the sacrifice. This was like, he's doing the Death of Wolverine. So, you know, this was sort of the one that had to go, I guess.
But overall, I thought it was a really, really, really great run. I didn't particularly love this storyline, but that's fine. But the whole run as a whole.
The overall conceit, you know, mm-hmm. of like trading off and it's my turn to do my job. I always liked that idea.
Yeah.
Yep. So I did like the ending bit where the guy's like, oh, I'm not going to kill you. Here's the deal.
Mm-hmm.
And he sort of convinces him to stop wasting his life. And I was like, that's cool. That works. That's nice. It's a nice way to go out. So, hey.
So Southern Bastards number 2, Southern Bastards number 1 was a pick of the week. This was also almost a pick of the week, just because it continues to be an amazing book from top to bottom.
I was really disappointed that Coach Boss didn't wear a white three-piece suit and a 10-gallon hat. I was really hoping
like that's a bolo tie.
That's the way he was going to go, but he didn't, so... Disappointed.
I thought it was kind of interesting that he has a very sort of like unassuming introduction. Like,
yes.
It was so built up in the previous issue, and here he's such a fixture of the town that, you know, he doesn't need. I mean, we see him from behind, and you know, there's a little bit of intrigue there, but you know, you don't really need.
It's Paulie from Goodfellas. It is like he doesn't put a show on. He doesn't move for anybody.
Right.
He doesn't do anything. He doesn't have to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know,
I really
that's
like
cool. That's power.
The tour's noses. They have this sort of M shape to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they all have been punched in the nose, first of all.
They're like cauliflower noses.
Do you have a cauliflower nose?
You know, cauliflower ears.
I also like that there was just a subtle bit of mysticism in this issue with the ending where the lightning strikes the spot. Well,
I think.
I can't imagine it's going to be like
what did he pull out of there?
It was the club.
Oh.
Or a club.
Wonder Bat? I mean, is that
basically,
what that was?
It was the Wonder Boy moment where the tree gets struck by lightning, the tree above his father's grave, and it reveals either his father's wooden club or a new club. But either way, you know, it's sort of that mythical element that is, you know, throughout the years.
It's like a Southern Gothic Thor.
Right.
Yeah, well, he wouldn't have gotten away with that in Scalp, so I guess that's the deal here.
Which is fine, because the rest of it is so grounded in reality.
Yeah. Oh, no, I'm fine with it. I like that it's actually a little heightened. I mean, like, you know, Coach Boss is it's pretty silly, and that's cool.
Until you're living in that town with Coach Boss, and it's not so silly, you liberal.
How long do you think I would last in a town like that?
Andy?
I mean, and like, are we even into the hour? I mean, like,
the question is, do you leave the house? Because if you don't leave the house, you could last a while, but...
I think they'd know. Also, I'd want to go out and get that barbecue, and that would be my undoing.
You would last until halfway through the meal. Try to eat as quickly as you can, because
this is just delightful smack.
Your plaid shirt, your bow tie, and your little hat, little trilby hat, you'd be dead before you got to cornbread.
What I wear when I eat barbecue.
Let's take a look at a little artistic challenge, and this wasn't presented in the first issue. It's just come up here. We're seeing, you know, a football game in process, and he takes this great, you know, sort of wide angle. It takes up two pages, you know, the top half, and I don't think I've ever seen that angle before in a comic book. I am not the person to ask if it is an accurate depiction, you know, of the layout of a football field, but I've seen very bad ones in other comics, which I won't name, but I think this is a good example. It brings you right down into the action. I know that's a really interesting point of view.
I think the football game, much like everything else in this book, is very, very visceral and feels very, very real, because these Jason Aaron and artist Jason Latour are both so from the South. It just feels
big
like
football fans.
And big football fans.
I know that Jason Aaron is at the least.
Yeah. I had a long conversation with him at our, I think, our last, very last New York Comic Con party about it. Long discussion about why he liked college football so much. It was very interesting.
Hmm. There's real
but
quick,
good.
There's, yeah, there's another just little mini mystery that I'm kind of interested. I don't think they establish it in the first. Did they say who he's talking to on the phone?
No.
Earl, I mean.
Maybe they mentioned, I don't remember. I'd have to go back and look.
And you know, it might not, you know, come to anything, but I think it's fascinating.
I think it's Diane,
that we,
isn't it?
Is it?
It's his assistant back at the FBI.
Oh my god!
Okay.
Oh my god, he is Agent Dale Cooper coming out of the Black Lodge. That is who he is. We've cracked it.
Well, anyways, I like seeing just the one half of the phone conversation, and I like when he keeps, I keep trying to get away, and it keeps coming back, you know, it keeps pulling me back in. I love that trope. I love that idea.
Much like Al Pacino, we're just going to keep bringing this back to mob movies. Cowl, number one, another new comic from Image Comics, another new series. Kyle Higgins, the Nightwing writer, and really, really great art.
Yes.
From Rod, we should mention Alex Siegel is also co-writing with Kyle Higgins. Rod Rice, who I can only assume is the same Rod Rice who inks his brother Ivan Rice over in DC, who, you know, he inks probably the most superhero-y superhero artist out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And here, it is a gorgeous book.
It really is.
The story is of the Cowl Organization, Chicago Organized Workers League. It's a superhero union protecting Chicago in the 60s. And I like the story. It got better as it went along. It was a little wonky in the beginning, but I was into it by the end. But really, for me, the story in this issue was the art, Rod Rice art, which I loved.
Yeah, same page here. I hope to see much more of this guy. Trying to describe it, I mean, there's like a bit of a Sienkiewicz thing going on.
Very much Sienkiewicz.
There's a little early Acuna. There's a little bit of... there's a little jock to it almost. There's just like... Yeah, I liked this. I was impressed by the art and everything. I didn't love it. I think I thought it was very good. I feel like I've read different versions of this story a lot. But I kind of like the setting. I think it's kind of cool to be in Chicago. You know, when is this?
I mean, there's the 60s. Yeah, it's that superhero deconstruction 62. Thing, and
yeah,
people have deconstructed superheroes in a lot of different ways, and. You know, this is sort of like if superheroes were, you know, funded
like the police,
like cops, basically. Yeah, and
they're gonna go on strike.
Yeah, and it's moody. It's this really atmospheric. The fight scenes are really cool. It's like, you know, feels like a fight scene in the rain, and you know, the color is really nice on that as well. Oh, but yeah, I mean, really, I think the takeaway is I want this guy drawing more books, and
yes.
Not, you know, inking other people.
Which is great. I think, you know, Ivan Rice is a great artist.
Sure, yeah.
His inks are great too, but if this is the same guy, I assume it is, unless it's some sort of amazing coincidence.
Yeah, nothing against Ivan Rice. I think this is just really special.
I also really liked the cover.
Yeah,
I thought the cover was really striking. Good week for Image.
The cover makes you think of a different time period. It seems like turn of the century steampunk kind of thing. So
we're going to talk about one more Image book later, but really strong week for Image Comics this week.
Yeah. I get kind of a spirit vibe out of the cover, but you know.
So we have mentioned a whole bunch of movies and TV shows in this first half of the show. So if you are interested in any of those, Godfather, Goodfellas, the Twin Peaks full collections coming out later this year.
Ooh.
What else have we mentioned? Casino. What was the movie you mentioned, Paul?
After Hours.
Yeah. After Hours. All those movies you can probably pick up at Amazon. By going to ifanboy.com/Amazon, that's where you find your Amazon portal. Helps us keep the lights on. We get a little piece of the sale. Nothing comes out of your pocket, comes out of Amazon's pockets. And they were in the news a lot this week. We're going to avoid that because that was awkward for everyone. But if you want to stick it to the man, you can.
I have an active Prime membership. What am I supposed to do?
Right. It's got to pay for itself.
I need a thing in 2 days. You know, I can't go. I can't. They don't have it here. What do you want me to do?
So we highly recommend all those movies. If you've never seen any of them, go ahead and buy them.
The man is a prisoner in his house. Prepare the drones.
So check those out at ifanboy.com/Amazon. Also, ifanboy.com/registration. That's where you can help us directly by becoming an iFanboy member at $3 a month, $30 a year, or by donating any amount you wish. That really helps us out. We have bills, keep things moving.
You know, I think I set it up on my dad's laptop so that he goes through the iFanboy Amazon portal. So now that he's into remote control helicopters,
sweet,
just an interesting hobby that he's taken up. And
that's a thing you can do. You should go through people's computers.
Yes, and switch them to the iFanboy link, their desk, their little shortcut, their bookmark. That's what you should do. Everyone could do that throughout the land. Now, real quickly, I wanted to mention Aquaman 31, which was the – we talked about it before. This is the Swamp Thing crossover. This is the second part of it or
They're
the opposite
tag,
side of it.
Tag team with Swamp Thing.
Tag team. And I loved it.
It was good.
Really, I love crossovers when they work like this. It's a fun pairing. The interaction between the two of them is funny. You know, Aquaman's very aggressive towards Swamp Thing. He doesn't understand who he's dealing with and – I loved those scenes between the two of them. I thought they were great.
This is not, you know, not a pairing that I ever really considered.
Makes sense though.
That makes a lot of sense, and I think Parker's really got a good Swamp Thing voice.
Yeah,
I think it's interesting that in Aquaman's own book, he basically was made to be Swamp Thing's lesser.
Swamp Thing very much was like, kind of his lesser.
Yeah, no, and it should be. It was just like, no, you don't understand. No, seriously, you don't understand. And I forget every once in a while that this is not the Swamp Thing that I always think it is. Mm-hmm. It's not the Alan Moore Swamp Thing who has one point of view, and he's very specifically not. He's Alec Holland. He's much more human. He's got that like, that sort of defeated, like, all right, fine. I'll show you. You know, he doesn't want to have to deal with it a little bit, but of course he knows he's going to because nobody else will. Yeah, it's good.
I think the human Alec Holland, the human Swamp Thing, sort of has less in common with other superheroes than the other Swamp Thing probably does.
Yeah.
He just has a completely different, you know, mindset. But yeah, I really like the way, and I like he's, you know, he calls him hero dismissively. He's, I'm an avatar, okay? Deal with it.
So now, this is the first issue of Superman I read since the first issue, which I just finished reading yesterday.
I tried, and I was, for a little while, I was like, all right, you know what, this isn't bad. And then near the end, I was like, okay, you lost me. It wasn't like really bad. The other ones were so good and interesting that I was kind of disappointed by this one.
Well, we can jump back into the other chapters. Yeah. I wasn't thrilled with this one either. In fact, when they changed artists in the middle, the costume completely changed.
Jeez.
His costume. It went to sort of the original Superman look to it. I was very confused for a minute. And his face changed. And so, yeah, I didn't really love this, but I'm looking forward to reading more of this story in the other chapters.
Yeah, I opted out. I think we'll be reading the other chapters and just skipping the Superman ones.
I love that the ad at the end is like Superman 32, Jeff Johns, John Romita Jr., the superstar creative team is here. What a thumb in the nose of the people who just did the book that you just
really,
read.
Yeah.
Oops.
Don't worry. These people will be shuffled away. You won't have to think about them anymore. But that's something to look forward to.
Paul, Miss Marvel.
Yeah, I want to continue banging the drum for this. You're on board now?
Yeah, totally.
This is really great. And this is, I think people were wondering, like, you know, when's she going to do superhero stuff? And, you know, last issue, she stopped a robbery in process at a Circle K there in Jersey City. And it's interesting because she knows the clerk, and they also know the guy who was the robber. And she accidentally gets shot, and we find a little bit more about how her powers work. She's a shapeshifter because she was hit with the Terrigen Mists, but she can't shape change when she's healing. If she stays in one shape, she can heal from a gunshot wound just fine. But then also the media comes in, and she wants to transform into the Carol Danvers, Ms. Marvel. And her friend is like, well, why don't you just be, you know, you? Why do you have to? And she has these ideas of what a superhero is. And I think this book does a really good job of playing to that message that it set out with in the beginning, which is, you know, what is a superhero supposed to look like? What are you supposed to be? And tying that in with being a teenager and your own identity issues without it being obnoxious about it. I think it's a great, warm little story. And we're finally meeting, you know, the big major villain for this, the Inventor, who's really creepy. It's just, she ends up in this scary house, and
yeah,
there's this creepy, you know, dude down there with a shirt that says "I am a bad guy." And
it was good. It's a really, really good book.
And it's I love Adrian Alfonso's art so much.
Really good.
Okay.
Yeah, good. No, the art's fantastic.
It really does look like it's a children's, like a picture book, which is, but the storytelling is great. It doesn't.
It's not the style I did in Runaways. It's slightly different, but yeah, it's very, beautiful. Very good. Yep.
Yeah.
So, did either of you guys read Revival Chew?
I did, and the tone is set right away. This is a flip book crossover. One side is Revival side, one side is Chew side, but there's a panel early on where the son from Revival is drawing his own comic, and it's Lion Cat versus the chicken from Chew. And his mother says, "Wait a second, Cooper, you've got a cybernetic rooster meeting a lie detecting alien cat. How's that crossover supposed to work?" And he says, "It's fun and it's cool. So that's all that matters. It's what comics are. It's what they're for."
Nice.
And so that sets the tone.
I like that.
That being said, I really liked the Chew side. I didn't think love the Revival side so much.
I liked both sides, and I liked that they were so different from one another.
Very different. They didn't match at all.
No, and that, I thought that was great. Cool. I actually didn't know what this was. I didn't know what to expect. I just picked it up and started reading it, and then I was like, wait, it's over? And then I sort of looked around, and I was like, oh, there's another story on this side. And so basically the team from Chew did an issue of Tony Chew coming to whatever this place is called in Wisconsin. And it felt like a Chew book, but with these characters. It was fun to see his version of them. Flip it over and turn it around the other way, and it's Tim Seeley and Mike Norton doing a story of Tony Chew coming there. He didn't do this cyborg, which I thought would have been funny, but I see why he didn't. But like it's Mike's sort of realistic depiction of Tony Chew, and a very different kind of horror story that Tim Seeley did in this.
I like how world. They fit the worlds together and yeah. sort of smash seamlessly. Like on the Chew side, Chicken is still kind of outlawed, where it's completely different on the other side. So they kind of fit in the Chew side, Revival gets fit into the Chew world, and the Revival side, Chew gets fit into Revival. I mean, I didn't dislike the Revival side. I just really liked the Chew side
It was just fun. And it's just like you said, like it was just like, wow, that's cool that they could just do that. And they did. And they did it for fans of the books and for themselves. And you know, that's great. Things like that should happen more. That's great. It's great. This was really fun. I was really happy with it.
Inhuman 2.
Charles Soule with Joe Madureira doing a really good Inhuman story. I'm like, this is the first good Inhuman story I've read in a long time. And I was just surprised that I was still going with it. And it was fun to spend time with Medusa and having her deal with Captain America. And I really liked Gorgon in this and the way that he treated the kid and his, you know, his training role. That's just a fun issue. And I actually really liked the Madureira art. I thought it was really, really good. It didn't feel old timey, I suppose. But I definitely, if you weren't reading this, it's worth it. And it sort of plays into this whole Terrigen thing that's going on, obviously.
Wasn't issue one way back with Matt Fraction? And
no.
No,
Charles Soule and Joe Madureira did number one. I know what you're talking about. That was a different thing, and I don't know.
It was different in Humans.
Yeah, that was in Humanity, maybe.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I could be wrong. I don't know.
Yeah.
All right. Well, those were the books we wanted to talk about this week. Go to iFanboy.com. You can talk about other books that came out. You can talk about these books. You can talk about anything you want over in the comments section for this show at iFanboy.com. And let's do a listener question. It's a long one. Strap in for Matt, who writes, you guys commonly refer to a few movies as bad movies. The ones that came out most recently were Prometheus and Man of Steel. They were compared to X-Men Days of Future Past, which was referred to as a good movie. I know this might be hard to nail exactly where your emotions are coming from, but when you guys are critiquing these genre films, do you come at them from a fan of source material or from a fan of movie making in general? I ask because, in full disclosure here, I'm an artist and a movie maker myself. I can pretty easily forgive not sticking to the source material as a trade-off for technical fidelity to the actual movie making process. When I compare films like Prometheus and Man of Steel to specifically the Fox-produced Marvel movies, I put the former on a much higher pedestal. The camera work, the visual effects, the depth of emotion, and the storytelling are all presented in a much more modern and high-quality way, in my opinion, of course. I can tell when I listen to the movie review shows that these things are not always at the top of the importance list for you guys. Things like the dated Colossus effects and the bad future Sentinel CGI were mentioned during the podcast were kind of glossed over to talk about things like how well Singer incorporated all of the cast and if the story fit in with the source material. When I watched Days of Future Past, I absolutely loved the Quicksilver scene and the depth of acting that we got out of James McAvoy and Michael Fassbender, but I felt like the rest of the movie felt dated. It fit in well with the original X-Men movies because it was made in a style that really harkened back to the late 90s, before the quality of the superhero genre film had been raised to what it is now. Things like the bad beast transformations, future punk costumes, little to no dialogue development from much of the extended cast really bummed me out and made a lot of the scenes feel throwaways for me. Anyway, now I've prattled on forever. I certainly don't want to make this anything more than a fanciful topic of discussion about what makes a good movie. I'd love to hear your responses.
It's a good question.
It is a really good question.
I got to sit for a while.
take a breather.
It's a good question, and I think a totally reasonable line of questioning.
There are definitely
yes and no, though. Mm-hmm. Okay. I feel like he's making a lot of false assumptions.
Well, I think that is the idea is like there's some movies that we all just sort of agreed are bad, and it's why. And that's hard to say, but I think that one of the things that is we as I don't like the word critic, but there we go, is people who sort of think about and talk about these kinds of things a lot. There are elements of things which we all have different tastes, I think, but there are certain things that tick all of our boxes, and then when I think when all of us agree kind of on a thing, then we just go, okay, that was just bad. Now, specifically, we're talking about Prometheus. I actually understand that that was not a great movie. I enjoyed it. I don't know why I didn't. I just like, I don't know, it looked cool, whatever. I could. It probably was a bad movie, but
yeah. I objectively, there are a lot of problems with that movie. I enjoy it quite a bit. I know fellow iFanboy staff writer Timmy Wood really likes that movie a lot and will defend it whenever it's brought up. I wrote the written review of Prometheus on the site, and I gave it a pretty high rating. If I reviewed it today,
you gave it 5 stars, I think.
Did I? No, I didn't. I gave it like a 4 or something, or 4 or 5. But it, you know, it's probably more like, you know, a 3 or something, or lower for a lot of people. But yeah,
the thing is. Matt's talking about at least 5 people's opinions here because I know Mike Roma was on the Prometheus show, and we're talking specifically about right. Ron Richards being on the X-Men show, and a lot of what he's talking about is stuff that Ron was talking about, specifically the fidelity to the storytelling, which if you've listened to our movie shows, we don't hardly ever put that on as an important matter because we've always said these are movies and not comics, and they've got to be good movies first. And then
we all pretty much are of the opinion that if you're going to make something into a movie, it's going to be different, and as long as that's good, then who cares?
When we do talk about it, it's when the differences are interesting.
Yes.
Or when they don't work, or if they're done for no reason.
Exactly.
Let's make that guy black. It's a bad example, but like no, it is, but like the idea when they change a character, that's a bad example.
It's arbitrary changes. It's the point is
Hawkeye. Hawkeye is a good example.
We never – and again, I don't want to knock Ron, but this is something he's always been more of a fidelity person than Josh or I or Paul has been in terms of source material. But he definitely has, but we did talk about it a lot in the X-Men podcast.
I think also Ron was doing that because he was brought on as he's the X-Men guy. We did miss having him on the show and we wanted to bring him back for something, but this particular one, we're like, you know, Ron loves the X-Men. He should be able to, you know, speak to that. So there was a particular reason why we chose that.
And I remember almost nothing about the comic book storyline Days of Future Past.
I never read it.
I have read it, but I couldn't tell you anything about it other than the general overview of it. And I don't know how close it was to the movie or not. I know Kitty Pryde went back in the time, back in the storyline, not Wolverine. But
judging
I loved
that based on
movie.
That. Based judging a movie based on the source material is always a slippery slope. It's what causes people to be mad at Lord of the Rings, not because it was bad or because they didn't enjoy it, but because it wasn't the thing that they'd already read, which to me is anathema. It doesn't make sense. You already read that story. Why do you need another version of it exactly the same?
That's, you know, and that's one of the reasons a lot of people, you know, dismiss. I think dismiss is the right word, Sin City, because it's just like, let's just slap the panels up on the screen.
It's the problem with Watchmen.
Right. It's an interesting experiment, but it's not the most artful way to do an adaptation. And I've always loved
Gus Van Sant's Psycho.
Right. That's a good example. I've always loved adaptation as, you know, a challenge. I think you can be equally as creative with an adaptation as you are with, you know, an original property. It's all in the decisions that you make with the tools that you have. I come from a screenwriting background. You guys are from, you know, a similar background in communications. We all took
media
different
critique.
Film classes. Yeah. And I think in terms of doing a 30-minute podcast, which we're usually shooting for 30, you know, 40 minutes on these movies, we sort of prioritize, and I think we prioritize the story. And if there are certain technical aspects in terms of the visual storytelling that jump out, we do mention them. Like with the X-Men podcast that we just did, we talked about, you know, Singer using the, you know, the sort of the vintage film stock sort of style for when Mystique goes out the window. Sorry, spoilers. But yeah,
she goes out a window.
And you see that in trailers too. That's fine. But anyways,
there's also matters of taste here.
There's defenestration, I mean, but yeah.
That is 100% the issue here. We did not like Man of Steel for its story reasons. That's why we didn't like it, not because it wasn't the Superman of the comics. If it was because his ethos was not Superman of the comics, which I think it had to be because that's the character. And
I think
I hate Prometheus because of, I think it's a dumb story with dumb characters, not because
sure.
Like what's it?
Michael Fassbender is very handsome.
So. I think also we evaluate these films in terms of what their priorities are, because I think it's often pretty obvious what the priorities of the filmmakers are. So we sort of look at what they were trying to do. So I'm not going to spend too much time on the Days of Future Past podcast talking about how it doesn't look like, you know, as visually interesting and arresting as the Nolan Batman movies. But I think that's pretty apparent.
The reason that you don't talk about that is because it wasn't bad enough to bother you. See, the thing is, if it bothered you, if it was that was the thing that took you out of the story, if you couldn't get over the fact that they looked like that, then you would bring it up. But the fact
besides, we've also been through four or five movies of these. It's like you can only complain about the punk rock look so many times.
That's a fact of life now. I mean, if
that's the world that they're in, that's that Singer X-Men world. They look like that. It's been 14 years of it, so we're not going to complain about it. In fact, we don't necessarily dislike it.
Yeah, I acknowledge that they're on a different level in terms of what they're trying to do, taking specifically something like Dark Knight and then this movie. But yeah, I think it's true. It's consistent. If it had veered off and done something much worse or much better, we definitely would have mentioned it.
I think there's lots of times though that we're like, you just talk about the costume or whatever. Okay, ultimately that doesn't matter. I mean, every time that we talk about all new X-Men. We're like, God, they look stupid. This is a really good comic book. And that's the end of the story. The fact is, in X-Men 1 in the year 2000, they took care of the costumes as far as I was concerned by Wolverine saying, what, are we going to wear spandex?
Right.
Like, he's like, that's dumb. And I kind of, like, I have no problem accepting that as the conceit. So,
My love of this X-Men movie has nothing to do with the story related to the comic book, but it's due to the fact that I think it was a super fun action movie with really compelling and charismatic cast.
Yeah,
there you go.
It's all about the movie and the movie techniques and the storytelling. I thought it was a really great.
I think
film.
If you were to go back and look at like the first Amazing Spider-Man movie, like I recognize that movie was chock-a-block full of flaws. I enjoyed when I watched it, so I didn't care.
Same case for Amazing Spider-Man 2, which just came out and we reviewed it, and that was a very interesting conversation because Connor was sort of in the middle. And I really enjoyed it despite its flaws. I acknowledge the flaws that it has, but I can't deny the fact that I was sitting there with a grin on my face the entire time. Timmy hated it, largely because he didn't get cast as Spider-Man, apparently, we found out. He has a little bit of grief there. But if I were to do a written review of that, I probably would have been more objective. I would have had to have been. But in a 30-minute podcast where we're getting views across, I think it's more about... It's more in terms of the larger picture. Did we enjoy it? Did we not enjoy it? What are the key things? And
same as comics. I mean, it's the same thing. I think end of the day, I'd like to say that some of it is objective and some of it kind of is in terms of how you build.
Well,
a story,
I think there's a lot of objective, and we've gotten in trouble in the past for being way too objective when people get very emotional about these movies. I mean,
and that's fair. There's always a trapdoor out of objective, but there are some things that we sort of take as granted. We all have educations in this stuff. We've also been doing this for a really long time now. Whatever. The point being, when you are reading critics, when you are listening to critics and they're talking about things like that, you're going to tend to go with people who have similar sensibilities to you, and you're going to want to listen to what they have to say because they either are better at elucidating the things about it that are important. But you're not going to there are reviewers out there who I'm not going to read because I don't agree with you. You'll find people who will give you information that will be useful to you, and that's kind of all we can do. And it's going to be subjective. There's no way it isn't. It's a taste thing.
It's art. Art is at its heart subjective. I mean, you can get objective about the fact that Ridley Scott, the director of Prometheus, shoots a movie better than anybody else who on this list of films we're talking about, objectively. But at the end of the day, it's also art. So you may not like the way he shoots a film. So that's just the way it goes. It's art.
Yeah. And I mean, there's all sorts of stuff we disagree about. But I think that at this point, we all basically – we respect – and we understand each other's differences a lot. Like Connor likes stuff I don't like, but I get it. You know, that's because that's his thing that he likes. I like stuff that I like stuff that Ron would never like. I can't get him to watch movies that I love for a million years, and vice versa. It's but you kind of go into
that. Paul and Josh are dumb enough to think Prometheus is a good movie. I respect that.
I don't think it's good. I thought
just enjoy it.
I thought it hooked me in because I thought that the world was really interesting. I loved the way it looked.
But we cannot respect Man of Steel being a good movie. That's where we draw the line. We draw line.
There were things that were cool about it.
No,
there were things liked about it. Absolutely.
No,
there was
some
great trailer
about it.
It's not allowed in my house. If it's on your phone, you leave that phone in the mailbox, and then you can come in.
But in the day, it's all about personal.
Why did he let his father get killed?
And
sorry, I can't.
I just don't think you can go back and listen to our shows and say that we review a film based on how close it is to the source material. I don't think that's possible. I really don't. I cannot think you can. I don't think you can make that argument.
So not interested in that.
Josh, this is a good opportunity for you to give your quick couple of minute opinion on X-Men Days of Future Past.
Oh, did you see it?
Yeah. Oh, cool. I actually did. I saw it the day after you guys recorded.
This is what we do now. We do a show.
I feel bad.
And then, like, 2 weeks later, Josh shows up and we get his quick opinion on the film.
I saw it a day after you did. And I'm going to make an effort to see Guardians of the Galaxy early so I can do that too.
Cool.
I'm really interested in that. So I hope I don't disappoint anyone with that. I really, really, really liked it.
Great.
I walked out and I thought, I think that was really good. And I checked in with Ron and Connor. I was like, you really liked that, didn't you? And they were like, oh my God. I was like, it had rebar. It retconned. I said all this. I basically went through all of the things that you guys talked about. I literally, like, if you could look at the text, it was like, it retconned X3, first thing I said. Like, and they were just, it was just, it had the one thing I think you guys didn't touch on enough was bombed out 70s Xavier.
Like, oh, yeah.
Just doesn't care. He's drunk. He's disconnected.
That was all wrapped up in how great McAvoy was in general.
He really was. And there's so many things you could say that. I'll tell you one thing is that, like, when I watched the Wolverine movie, whatever the last one was,
yeah.
I hated it. I couldn't get through it. Which is regardless of the fact, but what I was like, I don't want to watch Hugh Jackman do this anymore. I got into this and I was like, I'm totally into Hugh Jackman in this movie for whatever reason, whatever thing that was done differently. And it's the directing. I mean, let's be honest, you know, it was the tone, like it worked in this and like, he's got some more lines in his face and he looks a little older, like, you know, other than his ridiculous body.
And way bigger than he was in the original X-Men movie.
Yeah, totally.
I just watched it the other day. I was like, he's slim.
Well, it was been 73, so maybe he was more. It doesn't matter. I just liked a lot about it. I liked how it there were so many things. You know, like, there were so many things that were brought together, and there could have been so many balls dropped, and it just didn't feel that way. I'm not an X-Men purist. I don't know the story very well. I spent the whole time going, who is that girl doing the brain thing? And then I was like, oh, that's supposed to be Kitty. That doesn't make sense. Oh, well, I didn't care. Like, you know, and the fact is, for me, the thing that was super cool about X-Men First Class, the thing that was super cool about the first Captain America movie is that they were period pieces. They were in a time. This was a period piece in a time. It was 11 years later than the last movie, which is super cool because a lot of stuff can happen in that time. You know, I really loved it. It was great. I walked out. I was like, God, that might be the best X-Men movie I've seen in a while. And it's you guys mentioned, you know, we used to hold up X2.
Mm-hmm.
This is really in Spider-Man 2. Like, those were the old standbys of really movies. And that stuff's all been blown out of the water. Not that that's bad in retrospect, but there's just been so many sort of leaps taken since then. But now at this point, like, it's difficult to rank those movies because there are so many good and or interesting ones. And I don't want to rank them anymore. I don't care. I can put the best one. I don't know. I haven't watched Avengers again. So.
Yeah, and superhero isn't a genre anymore. Or at least it's a genre with many subgenres. So, you know, it's hard to say, you know, do I like Dark Knight better or do I like, you know, Iron Man better?
Well, I will say, like, I think there's a sort of tone in these movies that tends to work best. And it's a little bit of action and a little bit of heroism and a healthy dose of humor. And other than the Dark Knight and a little bit of the first Batman, it's pretty rough to sit through those other ones.
It's going to be a grim and gritty Man of Steel sequel.
Which is really interesting because, you know, and then at the same time, like, some of the Green Lantern, I don't know, just wasn't cool enough. So
boring.
Yeah, but I mean, there has to be something cool about it. And this was cool and it was funny and it was interesting and yeah, great movie. It was like a good movie. I told my wife was somewhere else that weekend that I was, which is how I got to go see it. And she went to see a movie on her own. And she's like, what should I see? And I was like, you should go see X-Men. And she's like, eh. And then afterwards, she's like, I should have seen X-Men. I was like, I told you.
Did you tell her that Hugh Jackman was naked in it?
I don't know if that's her thing. Maybe. I don't know if
you wouldn't know.
The whole theater's thing, Josh.
I mean, I'm not going to tell you. I wasn't impressed. Any day of the week, though, I mean, I'm going to go for Michael Fassbender because he's very, very handsome.
You can listen to our X-Men Days of Future Past show on the feed. It's two shows back. You can find me, Paul, and iFanboy co-founder Ron Richards making his return to the show talking about X-Men Days of Future Past.
Did you say Ron Fat?
Ron Fassbender. You're the one who hates fat people, Josh. Email us at contact@ifanboy.com or leave us a voicemail at 888-FAN-FATBOY.
Call that.
It's a fixation.
2697. Which, you know what? It's not so not true these days. Tell us who you are and where you're from and keep it around 30 seconds. for that to get on the show.
Fat boys.
Head over to iFanboy.com.
It was a it was a drive-in food place. It wasn't a bar. It wasn't a show.
Show.
It was comment on this show. Talk about this week's books, or you can go back to the X-Men show. Talk.
It was a performance venue. We're saying. Although,
do you remember the Fat Boys, Josh, in the 80s?
They're moving on along. Fat.
What was that movie called? Delirious. Was it called Delirious?
That was an Eddie Murphy concert film.
Yeah, you're right. It's called something like that.
Of course, I remember the Fat Boys. They were orderlies.
Oh, disorderlies. That was
disorderlies.
It.
There you go. They were they worked at a retirement home, I believe.
They were crazy orderlies.
I don't think I ever saw that. And I was totally into mid to early 80s hip hop movies because that was the thing I liked when I was 9 for some reason. I shouldn't have been able to watch Beat Street because it was not a child movie.
Paul, did you know the Fat Boys? Are you aware of the
I'm
Fat
not
Boys?
Aware of that now.
Really? At all? Wow, we did it. We lapped him finally.
There you go.
Oh, God. Next person in the script.
Oh, I've lost track. Follow the action on twitter.com/ifanboy, which means that we'll post what the pick of the week is beforehand. We'll retweet some good things. Maybe once in a while we even share a thought or two. You can go to facebook.com/ifanboy as well, and we'll update when the show goes up and things like that. And you can find out what the pick of the week is beforehand, all that. You can follow us on Twitter individually at J.A. Flanagan, at C.S. Kilpatrick, or at Fuzzy Typewriter.
I should really change the copy on follow the action. That one's my fault. It's very much follow the action in a Golden Pond sense of.
Hey, Ray Parker Jr. was in Disorderlies, Josh. He was pizza delivery man.
Was that post? Was that post 84?
Yes, it was 87.
Yeah, there you go. He was. I'm assuming by 87 he was cooling off.
Is the guy who did the Ghostbuster song?
Yes,
it was number one on the charts the day I was born.
What? Wow. Okay. Oh,
finally. If you dig this sort of thing, you can write us a review in iTunes.
I was talking about that soundtrack the other day because I got it, and then I didn't know what anything else was on it. I just figured it would be an endless loop of Ghostbusters type songs.
There's actually some not bad songs. I had that on vinyl.
No, I remember. I had the cassette. But
what is on the Ghostbusters soundtrack?
It's all songs from the movie.
Remember that, like, the movie that like, when they're all the town's turning, all the ghosts are coming out? And
I've never seen it. I don't know.
What?
As an adult, I've seen parts of it. I've never actually sat down and watched the entire
thing.
That is it's arguably the most important comedy of the 80s.
Whoa! I don't think we can do another show, Paul, until you watch it. That's your homework for next week.
All right. Should I do that? I'll watch Ghostbusters. Yeah, I've probably seen like all of it, just in the wrong order.
Yeah, but you've got to watch it in the right order. You'll be impressed. It's very good. It's a very good
thing. There's ghosts and it's like, a marshmallow thing. Yeah. Finally, if you dig this sort of thing, write us a review on iTunes, or better yet,
you're a fan of Wes Anderson.
Yeah,
the man relies on Bill Murray. This is the Bill Murray.
It's true.
This is the Bill.
Yeah, well, that's actually not true. It'd be Meatballs.
No, this is the no. Bill Murray.
Yeah, I know, but yeah.
Stripes.
It's a progression. Good. It's a progression.
I've seen Stripes. That's weird. Stripes, but I haven't seen Ghostbusters.
It goes Meatballs, Stripes, Ghostbusters. So by the time you get there, like, he is at his peak, and this is like
Eddie Murphy in Beverly Hills Cop.
Uh-huh.
After doing 48 Hours.
I watched 48 Hours recently.
It doesn't hold up as well.
Not as well. No. I mean, he's got charisma. He definitely does. And
Beverly Hills Cop is still
Nick Nolte is haggard
and racist.
Really racist. Like, they don't really get away with a lead character in a movie like that anymore. To call him that right in the movie and then have them fight and make up, because that's not happening anymore.
Very uncomfortable.
Although he does look really young, like Eddie Murphy, in a way that I was not expecting.
Yes.
We have 1,016 iTunes ratings. We still have 719 iTunes reviews. No new iTunes reviews this week.
People don't want Josh to leave.
If we hit 2,000, no, is it 1,000 iTunes reviews?
Yeah,
then Josh.
That's the next
out.
One. Then Josh is out. And then if we hit 2,000 iTunes ratings.
I don't even want to do that anymore, but I can't help it. It's like 94. Or it's
can we just continue to talk about 80s movies? Because I would do that for another 2 hours.
Sure. You know what I watched that was great? And Night Shift.
Michael Keaton.
Michael Keaton, Ron Howard.
Isn't Fonzie in that?
Yeah. He plays the uptight guy who works at the morgue?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. really good. Like
it's
I got
a really
it,
good movie.
I had it sent to me on disc from Netflix because I don't know, for whatever reason I wanted to, and like
it, that's like, the movie like, that made Michael Keaton a star.
Yeah. Like Lindsay and I watched, it holds up perfectly well. Really interesting. Really Shelley Long as a hooker, which doesn't make sense.
I was going to bring up Pump Up the Volume, but that's 1990. So
yeah.
Oh,
was shot in 89, I guess.
That's Christian Slater, right?
Yeah. Christian Slater. It's no Gleaming the Cube.
Who was on the Today Show recently and mentioned that he would love to do a sequel to Pump Up the Volume.
I'm sure.
Where he's just like some pathetic guy who's still working in radio.
Yeah, we were talking about this earlier in terms of Breaking Bad. The more I think about it, I don't think I want to pump up the volume sequel.
No?
I don't know if I really need to keep the regular one around. I don't know if that's a thing.
I own it on DVD.
Really?
Yeah.
What caused you to do that?
I caught it on TV on like a Saturday afternoon and I was like, I'm enraptured.
Okay.
Fair enough.
It's fine. Should we add this segment regularly? I guess we'll have to, I think that's pretty much everything I've got. So.
All right. So until next week, I'm Connor.
I'm Paul.
I am Josh. Nothing
clever.
Yeah, I'll go with that.